Welcome to Melanoma Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Like almost every nook and cranny of medical oncology today, laboratory and clinical research in melanoma is emphasizing novel biologic agents targeting specific molecular pathways. I met with Dr. Keith Flaherty at the ASCO meeting in Chicago for an update, and he began our conversation by providing a perspective on where things were and where they are.
The history in melanoma therapy has been roughly divided between cytotoxic therapies, you know, supposedly directed to the tumor cell, if you will, and then immunologic therapies trying to recruit the immune system. That's certainly been a decades-long divide of sorts. So with that said, the resetting the scale and admitting several years ago that escalating toxicity and combination regimens weren't getting us anywhere, now we've, of course, like other oncology fields, have really pursued totally different tacks. And the totally different tacks, though, still borrow from the history, which is to say we have tumor cell-directed therapy and we have immunologic therapy. And I would say that if you look at the ASCO abstracts from this year, they're almost equally weighted. Novel immunologics, and when I say that, I mean targeted immunologics, right? So CTLA-4 blocking antibodies, which we'll talk about because that's very much the order of the day right now. And then cell signaling inhibitors, so targeted drugs, you know, for trying to counter the molecular aberrations in melanoma cells that are not commonly found in other cancers. So this is an evolving story where melanoma will likely need somewhat of its own tailored targeted therapy, different from more common solid tumors. 2002 was the watermark year in which the most common oncogenic event in melanoma was discovered. So activating mutations in a kinase called BRAF, which is situated in the MAP kinase pathway, one of the signal transduction pathways that links cell surface receptors to basically all of the cellular processes that we blame on cancer. So proliferation, migration, angiogenesis, even escape of immune surveillance to some degree. The oncogenic activation of this pathway in particular and other signal transduction pathways that are similar are what we blame, frankly, almost all cancers as having aberrantly activated. In melanoma, we didn't know what turned on, in this case, the MAP kinase pathway until 2002. So about two-thirds of melanomas harbor activating mutations in this BRAF kinase in that pathway, turning it on constitutively. Beyond that, another 15% or so, 15 to 20%, have mutation of RAS, which is a now relatively famous oncogene where pancreatic cancer, for example, almost essentially always has a RAS mutation. Melanoma in about 15 to 20% of cases will have a RAS mutation. And when you see a RAS mutation, you'll never see a RAF mutation because these two are part of the same pathway. So a cancer cell doesn't need, if you will, to have both of these activated. And those discoveries, those two discoveries, really just immediately gave us targets, if you will, that we never had before. I mean, in other words, something that we could design drugs against to try to counter these pathways.
Now, when you say RAS, do you mean KRAS?
No, this is NRAS. So,
NRAS.
Right. So KRAS is the pancreatic cancer oncogene, and KRAS is mutated in many other cancers as well. NRAS, of the three well-known isoforms, KRAS, NRAS, and HRAS, HRAS infrequently harbors mutations in any cancer. But NRAS is the isoform in melanoma that's mutated. Now, the fact is, as I'm sure you've discussed in the context of other cancers, we don't have good RAS-targeted therapies yet. Farnesyl transferase inhibitors were being developed purportedly for that purpose, but they don't suit the characteristics of a targeted therapy the way that imatinib does as an ABL inhibitor or a c-KIT inhibitor in the two cancers for which it's useful, and certainly unlike Herceptin, Rituxan, monoclonal antibodies, yes, but those are very selective targeted therapies. Farnesyl transferase inhibitors don't have that property, if you will. And while that's still a conundrum for NRAS in melanoma, BRAF, on the other hand, drugs can be developed and now have been developed against BRAF. They're still in their early testing, so this ASCO is not very much about the current cutting-edge generation of BRAF inhibitors. A lot of work had been done, including a large phase 3 trial for which we still don't have the results yet, with sorafenib, drug FDA approved for kidney cancer and liver cancer. Now, currently, it's still being investigated in other cancers. And in melanoma, we got interested in it because sorafenib is a RAF inhibitor. Turns out RAF comes in three isoforms, so the story gets a little complicated. It's not a wonderful BRAF inhibitor, and BRAF is the thing that's mutated in melanoma. It turns out to be a reasonably good CRAF inhibitor, inhibits VEGF receptor signaling, which is why we think it's most important in kidney cancer. And that drug didn't work very well as a single agent, but with cytotoxic chemotherapy seemed to be relatively promising, either with dacarbazine, temozolomide, or carboplatin and paclitaxel, an unconventional melanoma regimen to some degree, but quite conventional regimen for other cancers.
Can you talk a little bit more specifically in terms of what's been seen in these studies?
Exactly. So in single-arm phase 2 studies, of which there were several, the both objective response rate and progression-free survival seemed to be about 2 times better than you would expect to see with those cytotoxic therapies on their own. So this story then would fit not so outside of the realm of bevacizumab combination studies. Bevacizumab is a single-agent therapy in breast cancer, colon cancer, and lung cancer. Very, very little activity, very little objective responses. Maybe a certain number of patients who had had maybe prolonged disease stabilization, yes, but hard to attribute that to the drug so much. So the point being that then it really amplified the effect of cytotoxic chemotherapy, doubling response rates, improving progression-free survival by at least twofold. So that drug, bevacizumab, a pure VEGF ligand-targeted drug, and sorafenib, which, yes, it's a RAF inhibitor, but again, critically, is a VEGF receptor inhibitor. So in that sense, it shares some of the same properties even with bevacizumab in terms of blocking VEGF signaling. This drug was showing a similar type of signal in melanoma, relatively little single-agent activity in single-arm phase 2 trials, but in combination with cytotoxic chemotherapy, compared to historical control, appeared to be doubling the response rate and progression-free survival. So that led to the conduct of 2 small randomized studies that were reported at ASCO last year. Unfortunately, negative – well, the first was a randomized phase 2 trial, so a truly small trial. That was actually positive, doubling of response rate and progression-free survival.
What were the arms?
That was a dacarbazine with or without sorafenib study, so fairly simple design in chemotherapy-naive patients, but only 100 patients in the entire study, 50 patients per arm. So hardly enough to change the standard treatment for melanoma, and of course the FDA wouldn't accept such a small study. But it was admittedly a randomized phase 2 study from the outset, so the idea was simply to serve as a basis for further investigations. We had investigated carboplatin, paclitaxel, and sorafenib in our group at Penn quite extensively and had generated the single-arm data, which gave rise to 2 randomized studies. The smaller of the two was one reported at ASCO last year, a 270-patient trial in patients who were chemotherapy refractory, so had failed dacarbazine or temozolomide-containing therapy, either single agents or combinations of chemotherapy agents. Those patients with metastatic disease but otherwise still good performance status and so on were randomized to receive carboplatin, paclitaxel, and placebo, so therefore just the chemotherapy alone, or the same chemotherapy plus sorafenib. Progression-free survival was the primary endpoint, relatively small trial, 270 patients, and that study was negative. So the randomized phase 2 study in frontline was suggestive of real impact, but the second-line study showed no difference in progression-free survival or response rate. So with those 2 pieces of data, the 1 final piece of data that will come with sorafenib, the only true phase 3 trial, if you will, is a cooperative group trial, intergroup U.S. study, so-called E2603, which is carboplatin paclitaxel with or without sorafenib in chemotherapy-naive patients, 800-patient trial with overall survival as the primary endpoint. And this is therefore the only overall survival study of the bunch seeking to corroborate the notion that sorafenib might impact the efficacy of chemotherapy in this disease. And at the conclusion of that study, if it's negative, then we'll say that unfortunately yet again in melanoma we've produced a negative randomized phase 3 trial. If it's positive, obviously it would potentially change the standard of care right off the bat if it's a survival endpoint that is reached. But then we'll wonder, did we just recreate the story that bevacizumab had already written in 3 other cancers now for which it's gained FDA approval? Or is this something different? Is this not VEGF signaling, a sort of a bevacizumab-like mechanism? Is this the RAF effect of sorafenib in this disease where, as I said, BRAF, this kinase, is mutated in 2/3 of all cases? We don't know truly, but I'll just give you 1 hint, which is that we've looked exhaustively to see who responds and who does not respond to these sorafenib chemotherapy regimens. And in single-arm studies, you cannot say that the presence of a BRAF mutation actually identifies the responding patients preferentially. It does not. Suggesting that perhaps it's not acting primarily as a RAF inhibitor in this concoction. Maybe it's more of this so-called anti-angiogenic or anti-VEGF effect.
Has Bev been looked at in melanoma?
So that's come along now finally. And you could argue that the sorafenib trials actually set the stage for that in some ways, the promising single-arm data. So the regimen that's being developed right now in a randomized phase 2 trial, which is still accruing patients, is a randomized phase 2 trial of 200 metastatic melanoma patients, chemotherapy naive, who receive carboplatin paclitaxel in the control arm or carboplatin paclitaxel Bev in the experimental arm. Progression-free survival is the primary endpoint. Again, a randomized phase 2 trial in classic sort of Genentech style, how they developed their other randomized studies before launching phase 3 trials thereafter. We would have the results of that study, hopefully ASCO next year. And by that time, we'll know if there's basis for launching a phase 3 trial of carboplatin paclitaxel with or without Bev.
Where's the phase 3 with sorafenib right now? When do you think we'll see some results?
We completed accrual now 3 months ago. It was a very rapidly accruing study, thankfully, throughout the intergroup, as I said. And that trial is, again, an overall survival endpoint. And so we're still accumulating follow-up data on these patients. And our best projection in this study right now is that we may not have data actually until not this fall, but the following fall of 2009, which admittedly is a good bit of time from now. But as I said, the trial has completed accrual and just in follow-up phase right now.
You mentioned the issue of sorafenib plus chemotherapy and the analogy to bevacizumab, where we hear a lot about this issue of mechanism of action. And why would an agent that we think of as anti-angiogenic work better with chemo? And we've heard the thoughts about normalization of blood supply, Riquet-James work, et cetera. Do you think that applies here?
Sure. We would be borrowing from the same set of arguments, not to say that that mechanism has truly been nailed down in any solid tumor. In animal models, you can make some statements that still don't quite get you to establishing that as the mechanism. In humans, very, very, very difficult to really nail that down. But yes, I think we would be saying that whatever it is that does the job with bevacizumab could hold here. There's been discussions, I'm sure, as in those conversations you've found, that altering interstitial pressure within the tumors might also have to do with chemotherapy delivery to some degree. Furthermore, there are macroscopic changes in tumors treated with VEGF-targeted therapy, be it bevacizumab or sorafenib, single-agent therapy, where one will see fairly wholesale necrosis of central compartments of the tumor with survival of the rim of the tumor. And there are those who will argue in hypoxia-related research that chemotherapy has always worked better at these well-oxygenated rim, if you will, and not so well in this oxygen-starved core. So if you're stripping out a bit of that core, if you will, with anti-angiogenic therapy, this goes away from a microscopic mechanism almost and takes you to a more macroscopic mechanism, which is to say maybe what you're getting is an effective hit of chemotherapy on the rim, which is what chemotherapy could always accomplish, but it couldn't knock out the core. And maybe that's the complementary mechanism.
You mentioned carboplatin. What about NAB in melanoma?
There's been a little bit of work, single-arm phase 2 trials only so far, with three different paclitaxel formulations, and NAB paclitaxel being one of them. But as you know, there is almost a family of paclitaxel modified delivery systems, if you will, that have been tested in, more commonly in breast cancer and other cancers that have been played with a bit in melanoma. I've been mentioning carboplatin paclitaxel as being an investigational regimen in melanoma in several ongoing trials. So when that flurry of activity began, that's exactly when these sort of modified forms of paclitaxel then began being played with to some degree. And I would summarize that data by saying that they look greater than or equal to, potentially, conventional paclitaxel. And when tested with carboplatin in these same types of designs, which has been done, I would say, again, the response rates and progression-free survival in these single-arm studies seem somewhat promising, not clearly revolutionary. But no phase 3 trial has been conducted to date. There is a phase 3 trial with Abraxane specifically that has been designed, not yet conducted, comparing it head-to-head to dacarbazine in previously untreated metastatic melanoma patients.
What do we know about the actual response rates, progression-free survival, and survival with any of these regimens, including carboplatin?
Right. The conventional statement is that you can get something on the order of a 10% objective response rate with single-agent chemotherapy. And if you summarize all single-arm and randomized studies in melanoma, you would hone in on a number like that. And that you can fairly reliably increase that response rate with combination therapy, including carboplatin paclitaxel, to get to a response rate of even in the range of 20% using RECIST criteria. But those response rates in previously conducted randomized studies, none of which have used carboplatin paclitaxel, but in previously conducted combination versus single agent trials, that difference in response rate, which has been real in several studies, statistically significant, has never translated into a difference in overall survival. Progression-free survival, a little tougher to summarize decades worth of data because progression-free survival, frankly, wasn't reported in many early trials. But progression-free survival to single-agent therapy, you would summarize as being on the order of 1.5 to 2 months. Median progression-free survival is generally always when the first follow-up scan is done on a clinical trial in melanoma. So that's 6 weeks or 8 weeks, essentially, depending on the protocol. Combination chemotherapy has fairly reliably looked more like a progression-free survival of about 3 months. So a modest increment, if you will. Some trials, that's looked statistically significant, in other cases not. But once again, those same differences have never meant anything at the level of overall survival in any of the previously conducted randomized trials. a key missing link here based on all the conversations we've touched upon with chemotherapy in melanoma is that there hasn't been, for example, a carboplatin paclitaxel versus dacarbazine trial. So if we're going to invest all this time and effort building platforms of novel therapy on top of carboplatin paclitaxel with sorafenib, bevacizumab, and other new agents coming along, do we really even know that carboplatin paclitaxel is really in any way better than dacarbazine? We don't know that, certainly at the level of overall survival. There's several novel signaling inhibitors. These are, again, trying to take advantage of these oncogenic events that I commented on before. We discovered them essentially in the early part of this millennium, certainly in 2002, with BRAF mutations giving us a real hot target, if you will. But it took several years for drugs to come forward that were developed professionally, if you will, to inhibit these targets, BRAF specifically. So sorafenib was a drug that was already extant at the time and in human development when BRAF mutations were discovered. Turns out not to be a wonderful RAF kinase inhibitor, certainly not a wonderful BRAF inhibitor. So there are BRAF inhibitors that are, if you will, professional BRAF inhibitors still actually working their way through phase 1 trials now. We'll hear data from them for the first time at ASCO next year. There are
any names on those yet?
These are still code names.
Numbers
RAF, RAF265 in the case of one of the drugs and PLX4032 in the case of the other. These are the number 2 and number 3 RAF kinase inhibitors in human trials following sorafenib. So there's quite a gap actually of about 4 or 5 years from negative phase 2 results with single agent sorafenib melanoma before these drugs finally were ready for testing in humans. There are MEK inhibitors, MEK inhibitors, that are being developed particularly for melanoma. In fact, this is a point that's just below RAF kinase in the MAP kinase pathway. It's the next kinase down in the chain, and it's been shown in the laboratory that you inhibit MEK in a cell that harbors one of these activating BRAF mutations that you will harm that cell by and large, and that you don't have that same effect in cells that lack those mutations. So it suggests there might be a therapeutic index there. The interesting precedent that these investigations are setting is that here you have an oncogenic event like a BRAF mutation, and you're purposefully targeting downstream of it, if you will. In other words, trying to intercept it at the next point in the cascade. Never been done in cancer. All of the targeted therapies that you talk about in other cancers are ones that have attacked the oncogene specifically. So we don't know about the viability of this approach. It could be that resistance would emerge particularly quickly with this type of approach, or perhaps not. You know, there are people who argue on both sides of it. The human investigations are simply too immature to make any conclusions about that yet. But I'll tell you this, that two MEK inhibitors entered human development in 2004, which is enough years ago now that we've not only completed phase 1 testing with those drugs, but now one of the two has completed phase 2 testing in melanoma as a single agent. And reported at this ASCO for the first time was a fairly large randomized phase 2 trial of one of these orally available MEK inhibitors, so-called AZD6244. It's another code name. Patients received that drug as a single agent oral therapy or temozolomide in the control arm of this randomized phase 2 study.
Let's talk about, you know, clinical management.
Yes.
Off protocol.
Yes.
I'm sure you're trying to get every one of your patients on study.
Yes.
But
yes.
What about non-protocol management of melanoma? Let's start out with just, you know, stage 4 disease.
Right.
How do you approach it?
It's still the case that if a patient is not eligible for a clinical trial at an academic center like ours where we conduct simultaneously multiple melanoma trials, I would guess I would say in my hands, the reason the patient is not eligible for a trial is probably going to be a factor that's going to influence my selection of therapy. And what I mean by that is the presence of a brain metastasis, very common phenomenon, asymptomatic or symptomatic. 40% of patients, up to 40% of patients who present with metastatic disease, asymptomatic in terms of the possibility of a brain metastasis, are found to have a brain metastasis with MRI scanning, which is current standard of care to survey for that possibility. A number of clinical trials will exclude those patients outright. So that's one example of something that you then have to focus just what will you offer that patient in terms of therapy. Another distinct possibility is the patient either has a significant number of comorbidities and add it all up, they're simply not clinical trial candidates, or their performance status is suffering because their disease is fairly advanced, fairly aggressive, and is taxing them such that they're not trial candidates. So for each of those scenarios, the discussion goes a little differently. But what I would say is that for the patient who has a significant number of comorbidities or a very compromised performance status, you can imagine that very intensive therapy, very side effect intensive therapy, if you will, is really not the order of the day. It's difficult even to contemplate the idea of combining, let's say, sorafenib or bevacizumab with cytotoxic chemotherapy in those folks. Not that those are horrendously toxic regimens, but these are relatively fragile patients, and there we typically lean on things like single agent temozolomide or perhaps a single agent taxane as our standard treatment. Weekly taxanes, for example, having been both tested and oftentimes clinically used, but testing has only ever been done the single-arm phase 2 level. So off-protocol, those are the standard go-to regimens. High-dose interleukin-2, certainly off the table for that type of patient. And that's in-hospital therapy. That's terribly difficult to administer to anyone who fits that description. And so we typically go with single-agent cytotoxic therapies. This is true nationwide and in Europe for those patients. For patients with brain metastases, if they're asymptomatic, our current algorithm is to be fairly aggressive in terms of trying to control those. If they are candidates for stereotactic radiotherapy, that's what we'll offer. And that is really a modality that I'm sure you are aware has really become very widely available, not just major academic centers in big cities, which was the case a decade ago, but now large practice groups and others have brought in that technology such that it really, I think, can be embraced as a more of a treatment standard. So we tend to be very aggressive about it because those are life-limiting manifestations of disease for patients with melanoma very, very frequently. So if they have a relatively small number of brain metastases, we will send them for stereotactic radiation when we've discovered them at initial presentation. For symptomatic patients, oftentimes they are not candidates for stereotactic radiation because of the sheer size and number of the lesions that are causing symptoms. Unfortunately, therapy for those patients has not evolved one iota in the past couple of decades or so. Whole brain radiation, not particularly effective in modifying natural history of disease for those patients, but it's still offered. And then going back to single-agent chemotherapy as the systemic approach, if you will, with temozolomide being a drug that I think you know for its use in glioma does have CSF penetration. No, it doesn't have wonderful response rates or progression-free survival in melanoma, all told. But in that patient with brain metastases, it is the conventional standard offering for those folks. But for folks who have a small number of asymptomatic brain mets, candidates for stereotactic radiation, we will focus briefly on treating those brain metastases with stereotactic radiotherapy and then basically pursue therapy otherwise as though we, you know, weren't confronting that problem. The natural history data would support that those patients actually don't have a worse outcome if they're candidates for stereotactic radiation than patients who have no brain metastases whatsoever. So in terms of off-protocol therapy, we'll offer them the same treatments we would otherwise. And actually, increasingly, protocols are allowing those patients, if they're candidates for stereotactic, not requiring corticosteroids, then they are actually frequently more often eligible for clinical trials now. Let me comment a little bit about these targeted immunologic therapies that I raised before, which are being really brought to the forefront in terms of melanoma investigations, as they're being pursued to some degree also now in a few other cancer types. The two that have moved the field the furthest so far are the CTLA-4 blocking antibodies. So CTLA-4 is a receptor that resides on T cells that essentially is a negative regulator of T cell function, which is to say that a dendritic cell, the interface with a T cell, this is the information sharing, if you will, to say that there's something abnormal and you, T cell, need to do something about it. That interface is an interface of multiple proteins at the cell surface, and CTLA-4 sits on the surface of the T cell, and basically if it is bound, it will tell the T cell, don't worry, don't do anything about this problem. It's okay. One reason that that would happen is if this is a self-antigen, right? This is just a normal protein in your body being shown to a T cell. You want to not react to that. And so this is part of that signaling process, if you will. Turns out, if you block that interface, in other words, if you don't allow the CTLA-4 receptor to receive that quote-unquote negative signal, you will get the T cell in an aggravated state, an activated state. You're pulling away a negative factor, if you will. So the monoclonal antibodies, two of which are in phase 3 testing, and this ASCO, we heard the results of one of those phase 3 trials. So that was, I would argue, the highest profile clinical trial presented at ASCO this year, tremelimumab, as it's called, one of these CTLA-4 blocking antibodies. In other words, it's an antibody that binds the extracellular domain of the CTLA-4 receptor and essentially sits in a position that doesn't allow it to be bound and then to send a negative signal. So that's why it's referred to as a blocking antibody. So this drug and its counterpart, ipilimumab. So tremelimumab is the CTLA-4 antibody that has been evaluated and reported at this year's ASCO in phase 3. Ipilimumab, which is its cousin, also in parallel development, has completed accrual to a phase 3 trial, but we don't have the results yet. We expect them in about 6 months. These two drugs both will induce two phenomena. They will induce autoimmune toxicity. They will get the immune system so aggravated that it will attack normal tissues. The intestine, the skin are the two most common. And then behind that, there are a plethora of other sites. Almost any site of the body that you know that can be involved with autoimmune disease of other derivation can be found with this drug. Severe autoimmune toxicity occurs in roughly 30% of patients treated with these drugs. When I say severe, though, this is reversible with corticosteroid therapy. So it doesn't have to be and typically is not something that's truly life-threatening when it occurs, and it can be abrogated with corticosteroids. So the other phenomenon that it unleashes is an anti-tumor response. About 10%, roughly, 8% in some studies, single-arm phase 2 and now phase 3 trials, about 10% of patients will have very robust tumor regressions, partial responses, occasional complete responses buried into this same number of 10% or so. These responses typically do not manifest immediately. They typically take several months to manifest, and there are even occasional patients who will show some degree of tumor progression before all of a sudden the tumors come crashing down and regress. Even some patients who've had complete response ultimately started that way early in the course of therapy. So both the autoimmune toxicity is delayed, typically not within the first few weeks, but the first few months of treatment, but likewise the responses occur around the same time. So for reasons that we do not know, about 1 in 10, roughly, melanoma patients can have a really robust response to these therapies. And when they develop a response, that response is almost always very durable. And when I say very durable, these drugs have been in testing now for 4 or 5 years now. There are patients whose responses are still 4 or 5 years and ongoing, some complete and some just partial responses that are still that durable. The occasional patient will lose those responses, but that's actually relatively infrequent. Here's one of the tricky parts of this story. If someone develops autoimmune toxicity and an anti-tumor response, and you are forced to give corticosteroid therapy to stop the autoimmune effects, essentially, in all cases where that overlap exists, you don't lose the anti-tumor response by giving corticosteroids. Almost too good to be true. Why would it be that corticosteroids, which are sort of nonspecific immunosuppressive therapy, if you will, how is it that it could allow anti-tumor attack to be persistent but to pull back the autoimmune effects? We truly don't know that. I really have no insight into why that happens, but we do know that it happens. Now, the key punchline from this year's ASCO is that all that I've said is confined to 10% of patients. There are patients who were reported in single-arm phase 2 trials to have very prolonged disease stabilization. Their disease had been progressing previously. Then they were treated with such a drug, didn't have regression, didn't have progression, but maintained that for years' time. And if that happens for years' time, even on a single-arm study, we tend to believe that's probably real. We didn't know how prevalent those patients might be. The phase 3 trial that was presented at ASCO this year was the critical test of that. And I'll explain. It's a large trial, over 600 patients randomized to receive tremelimumab, one of the CTLA-4 antibodies, or dacarbazine, or temozolomide, one-to-one randomization, overall survival primary endpoint, with secondary endpoints of progression-free survival and response rate. So the same 10% of patients responded that have been seen in previous trials. So that was corroborated. But there was no impact, no difference whatsoever in overall survival between these two populations, none whatsoever, which was very disappointing. But what that result established, if you will, is that there can't be very many of these patients with very prolonged disease stabilization to supplement the 10% of patients we know respond. Simply put, 10% of patients responding to a therapy is not enough to drive a phase 3 trial, unless you do a several thousand patient phase 3 trial.
Any patients in your practice that you could briefly discuss without any identifying information, maybe that have received some of these newer approaches where, you know, the result was pretty unusually positive that you could talk about?
Absolutely. We've conducted so many trials with so many of these agents that we've talked about so far. It's fairly easy to say that basically in each camp for these novel cell signaling inhibitors, these signal transduction inhibitors that we think are most appropriate for melanoma, where we've conducted a lot of clinical trials with these agents, we have seen patients who've even responded to these drugs as a single agent, although admittedly they're relatively few and far between. Certainly in the trials with sorafenib and chemotherapy, not only did we see that on average there seemed to be more responding patients and so on, but more importantly, and I think getting to your honing down to the individual level, we have patients who now years after we initiated therapy are still progression-free, you know, essentially in remission of either partial or complete remission from the therapy that they started years ago. That's quite uncommon with chemotherapy alone.
Anybody stick out in your mind?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the more spectacular responders of ours to sorafenib and chemotherapy on a single-arm phase 2 trial years ago, that we started years ago, is a patient who had melanoma that involved lymph nodes, both regional and mediastinal lymph nodes, an adrenal metastasis, a small lung metastasis as well.
How old was the patient?
He was in his young 50s at the time. maintained an excellent performance status.
He had a prior localized melanoma?
He did, and that was resected and had lymph node, regional lymph node involvement that was resected, but then recurred with distant disease thereafter.
He had adjuvant therapy?
He did not have adjuvant systemic therapy. After discussing the options way back then, he decided not to pursue.
So when did he present with metastatic disease roughly?
So this was in 2002 that he presented with metastatic disease.
What was his situation, his condition at that point?
He felt well. You know, each of these sites of disease was radiographically evident both by CAT scan and PET scan, but he was not symptomatic at the time, still working.
What kind of work did he do?
His surgeon, actually.
A surgeon? A
practicing general surgeon, and he continued working through
family
this
situation?
Time. Two small children, married, and really was, although disheartened by the diagnosis, was still able to carry on day in, day out.
So he presents in 2002 with metastatic disease.
Right, and we treated him initially with just temozolomide single-agent therapy, which was his preference after discussing the various options, including a number of clinical trials that were ongoing. So he received two cycles of that therapy, clearly radiographically progressed, not as rapid as some melanoma patients' progression can be.
Still asymptomatic?
Still asymptomatic. Well, he did have a palpable lesion that he was aware of, if you will, but otherwise asymptomatic. So with two cycles and progression and no real obvious path to go outside of a protocol, he agreed that a protocol would be more suitable. We enrolled him on the carboplatin paclitaxel sorafenib trial, noting that those chemotherapies, as you well know, in lung cancer and other settings where they're used, are relatively difficult therapy, especially for a practicing surgeon to put up with. And certainly with neuropathy
right.
there as a cumulative toxicity over multiple cycles, certainly a concern. But he felt that his back was against the wall. He had little other choice. So he was willing to engage the relatively predictable toxicities of the chemotherapy. And so he initiated that regimen, and after just two cycles, had evidence of a partial response.
What's the actual regimen? Where does the sorafenib come in?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of an interesting twist there, because sorafenib's oral therapy, standard dose is 400 milligrams twice a day. And in this trial, we actually had to establish that it was safe to co-administer these drugs in phase one testing. And we had enough concern that paclitaxel and sorafenib might interact with each other in terms of metabolism, that we actually didn't co-administer the sorafenib on the same days patients were getting chemotherapy. So out of a 21-day cycle, they would take the sorafenib and still do in all the trials that I've summarized, day 2 to day 19 out of a 21-day cycle, two-day washout, if you will, before the chemotherapy, and then start again the following day. So it's nearly continuous therapy, but a three-day out of every 21-day break, if you will. So that concomitant administration of therapy, if you will, he pursued for two cycles, so 6 weeks, with every 21-day carboplatin paclitaxel, and had evidence of a partial response even after the first two cycles. But as was typical for other patients on the trial who responded, he, after two more cycles, had an even deeper response, if you will, and basically resolved completely lung and adrenal lesions, still had a little bit of evidence of lymphadenopathy. Eventually, we got around to doing a follow-up PET scan, which is not standard, actually, in melanoma still to follow responders with PET scans. But it seemed that he clearly did have less evidence of disease by that point. And he continued on the concoction of chemotherapy with sorafenib for 10 cycles, but at reduced doses of chemotherapy at that point per protocol. So we never let neuropathy rise to be too big an issue. He was obviously quite concerned about that. Sorafenib he tolerated quite well, did have a rash early in the course of taking sorafenib, which is very typical.
Where was the rash?
It's truncal mostly in his case and a little bit on the face, but it's fairly short-lived, the sorafenib rash. It's usually the first few weeks of therapy, and by the first month and a half or so, it typically dissipates.
Do anything local about it?
We've tried lots of tricks, and no. Although it can be pruritic, we use things like Benadryl and Atarax to try to ameliorate that. Topical therapies, we've tried lots of different things, even topical corticosteroids, and never really found anything that seems to alter it.
Does it get better on its own?
It does. Even with continued therapy, patients who have a lot of it, so-called grade 3 rash, so more than 50% of their body surface area, will hold therapy.
But and in him, you kept going?
Yes. And in him, not really even something you would threaten grade 2 so much, so he kept going right through therapy. And eventually hit somewhat of a plateau based on his scans. And we stopped the chemotherapy, as I said, after finally about 6 months, roughly.
Did he have any neuropathy by the time you stopped?
He did have a small amount. He had mild neuropathy through the last few cycles of chemotherapy. We were concerned it was getting a little more than mild, but that was right at the time that we had essentially prospectively planned to stop the chemotherapy, which we did. He stayed on single-agent sorafenib thereafter, which was the protocol design and how it's been used in these subsequent trials as well, as just single-agent therapy with the idea of trying to maintain the response. Do we know that that's the right thing to do with sorafenib or, for that matter, bevacizumab? No, we don't know it's the right thing to do because we've never seen the other approach tried where you just stop everything and hope for the best in these types of regimens. So he continued single-agent sorafenib, which was not a difficult thing for him to do. Like most patients who are on chronic sorafenib, he developed diarrhea over more time, very typical sort of delayed, if you will, toxicity. Occasionally requires dose interruptions. Imodium manages it quite nicely for the vast majority of patients, which was the case for him, and he wanted to continue taking the drug as much as possible. And he eventually, after about almost a year and a half, actually lost all radiographic evidence of disease. He didn't have a lot left to lose, if you will, but both by CAT scan and PET scan, we saw no evidence of disease. And after 2 years, so we noted that at about 18 months, after 2 years, he discontinued sorafenib in the setting of a complete response and is now still disease-free.
Wow.
This number of years later, it was 2002, I said the story started, so we're 6 years out that has all transpired.
You biopsy the recurrence?
Yeah, so we had tumor tissue from a lymph node. He had regional lymph node involvement. Was part of his stage 3 diagnosis, but then he recurred, as part of his recurrence, he had more disease there, which we...
And that went away?
That went away. I mean, all that evidence of lymphadenopathy.
So the thing he was feeling went away?
Correct. That disappeared early. He knew he was responding early in the first few cycles. And interestingly, I'll mention, as part of that study and in subsequent trials as well, we actually analyzed his tumor tissue to find out if he had one of these mutational events and so on, and found out, sure enough, that he has one of these very common BRAF mutations in his tumor. Is that why he responded so well? The story isn't yet told well enough to be able to determine that. But nonetheless, that's a nice example.
So he's walking around now free of disease?
He is, completely.
Wow. How old are his kids?
Now they're 10 and 12. They were a good bit smaller when we started all this, but they're moving along.
What's it been like to see that?
I have to say, it's quite remarkable in melanoma to have patients who respond.
You've got a bunch of people like this, or hardly any?
Yeah, on that one trial, we have 5 patients, in fact, who are still alive now, 5 and 6 years later.
Really?
Yeah. And so there's no doubt, based on reputation, that melanoma is just not a disease that you feel allows for the possibility of that to happen. And most patients have that, even if we don't really tell them that. They have that notion. I mean, they get that impression from doctors, certainly if they do any reading on the topic, they get this notion that it is going to be a fatal disease. So it's difficult, frankly, for patients to walk away from that, right? I mean, survivors in other cancer contexts, long-term survivors, even with still evident metastatic disease, is, in the case of breast cancer and so on, maybe a bit more common. So people are used to the idea of so-called living with their cancer. In melanoma, there aren't so many patients that have that happen that it's sort of part of the psychology. So in his case, I would have to say that he is, still to this day, as you can imagine, very shaken by what he was sure was coming.
I can't even imagine being in that situation.
Yeah, no doubt. And every visit we have now is really just, wrestling with his attempt to sort of, try to put that behind him mentally, which I have to say in these past couple of years, he's done quite well in doing it.
And I guess you have no clue if he's going to relapse in the future.
Right. And it's very hard to know how much confidence we can have as each year passes. So in other words, in the setting of stage 3 disease, for example, typical stage 3 melanoma, macroscopic involvement of lymph nodes, the recurrences cluster, as with almost any cancer, in the first few years of follow-up, such that for a patient with stage 3 disease, if they're 5 years out, you're feeling pretty good about their chances of never having disease reoccur 10 years out, certainly. And with him, we don't know if we can use that same type of mindset. I mean, can we really gain, exponential confidence year by year, as I've said we do in the setting of stage 3 disease after surgical therapy?
It's just so interesting, particularly because of the fact that his medical background, probably being 100% knowledgeable of what he's dealing with, to be walking around like that.
Exactly.
Wow.
And I think it's exactly right, because other patients of mine, and even the others I can think of from even that same trial, might be more willing to accept sort of a miraculous nature of how some people can do in the setting of cancer. But with his medical background, I would say he would be a little bit more soberly aware of the fact that there are some people who have surgically curable disease and who live, and there are others who don't. And that's how he had envisioned it to begin with.
Yeah, it's interesting because we try not to think about anecdotal medicine.
Yeah, but you
listen to this case and and you're telling me it's not like the only case you've seen like that.
Right,
it's pretty compelling in terms of, maybe, I don't know, now that I hear all this, it's funny, when you went through all the data, I was like, well, it doesn't sound all, honestly, maybe I missed it.
No.
I mean, I know I heard what you said about how it impacted the numbers.
Yes.
But listening to that, I don't see anybody jumping to use it off study.
Right.
Having heard what you just said about this case, I'd be thinking about at least referring somebody to a trial. I don't know. Maybe what about trying it off study?
Right. And that certainly does occur. We can track that fairly easily, that sorafenib, as I said, FDA approved now for 2 indications. Its use in melanoma does exist, no doubt. And based on the data that I've already summarized, it can only be supported by these sort of single-arm phase 2 outcomes that we and others have reported. And so what you can say about sorafenib, certainly since it's been on the market now for several years, it's a fairly well-tolerated drug, certainly some toxicities to wrestle with, doesn't seem to augment the toxicity of chemotherapy meaningfully. And so in that sense, I would say there's relatively little downside. So if a patient is study ineligible, trial ineligible, or truly trial uninterested and or unwilling, then I think it's a therapy that one could contemplate. We've done a bit of work now using sorafenib with temozolomide, which is a far more tolerable chemotherapy than carboplatin paclitaxel. I suppose in some ways I would say that if a patient were to confront me and be in that situation where they just had no protocol options and they still wanted to try to be marginally aggressive, if you will, I still probably support the notion more of a less toxic chemotherapy like temozolomide with sorafenib, where we've done a large-scale study, seen similar outcomes with patients now still, you know, years and counting with durable responses.
You've seen patients, same story, which you just told.
Yeah, absolutely. Even with a less aggressive chemotherapy backbone, we've seen the same. And in that very large trial, we had an arm of that study in which patients who had brain metastases at baseline were treated. There's an attractive potential regimen for brain metastases. And some of our best longer-term outcomes were patients on that who had brain metastases at baseline, which is a really seemingly unrecoverable situation.
Wow, so you've had people with brain mets who survived for years, right, and the brain mets went away?
Responding like the disease elsewhere. I mean, still, you almost always still see some abnormality, if you will, but in abnormalities that on follow-up MRI are never changing, we presume there's either no viable melanoma there or it's in hibernation like the rest of their disease.
Any sort of rough ballpark guess how often you see these kind of remarkable responses?
I think those I can't claim that we've seen in more than 5% or so of patients. Put all the trials together, these really ridiculously durable responses. And in fact, in the small randomized studies that I mentioned, which were multi-center, you know, far beyond our institution, the number seems to be similar. The accumulating percentage of patients seems to be about that again, that these sorafenib chemo-treated patients, some of them have this very long-term benefit. You know, it gets back to the issue in melanoma that, you know, not all hope is lost. There are some patients who respond to therapy. It's why, as I said, why do we even offer dacarbazine or temozolomide to patients? Because occasionally you'll find someone, you know, it's uncommon. It is quite uncommon, 1% of patients maybe, who will have a really fairly dramatic response to those chemotherapeutics. But the point being, again, that with these investigational regimens, sorafenib chemotherapy or these CTLA-4 antibodies, you know, so totally different types of therapy, nonetheless, these drugs really work in a small subset of patients. And I would say that one philosophy as we try to move the field forward is that historically we keep looking at melanoma as one thing and we keep waiting for the home run that's going to just completely transform us. Maybe we'll get lucky. It's still possible, I suppose. The reality is, though, that if we can identify who it is that responds to sorafenib chemotherapy, that 5%, and they're relatively taken care of. If we identify the 10% who respond to these CTLA-4 antibodies, they really seem to do well longer term. And if these Venn diagrams don't overlap, in other words, these subsets of patients are truly distinct, then start thinking about adding up those numbers in your head to eventually just start chipping away so that you have a larger and larger percentage of the melanoma population for which these therapies are really attractive. And let me just mention another little teaser of sorts, which is that we've just learned within the past year to year and a half that about 3% of all melanomas, a small subset, I'll grant you, have the same c-kit mutations that you find in GIST. And there are trials ongoing quickly trying to follow that story by using imatinib in those patients.
I think I saw one with your name on it here at ASCO.
Right, so in fact, but there are others who...
What did you see there?
There are others who've been doing this now, trials, but actually even a few anecdotes of patients just treated flat out. And I'll put it this way. Of the patients who've been presented at meetings, you know, small scale, large scale, but patients who've been presented now publicly as being treated with imatinib after being identified to have a c-kit mutation first, all of the cases have responded. I mean, this is 8 for 8 so far in counting in terms of patients prospectively identified to have one of these c-kit mutations. The story is a little bit more complicated in that superficial melanoma, skin melanoma, if you will, which is the most common type of melanoma, and it's what people typically succumb to, that's not where you find these c-kit mutations. It's in mucosal melanoma and so-called acralentiginous melanomas of the palms and soles. Those melanomas, they don't all have these c-kit mutations, but a subset of those will have it. And so, you know, this is an example of where targeted therapy potentially cuts across diseases a bit, right? You think of c-kit as a GIST target, and appropriately so. But I think we're going to learn more and more that defining cancer under the microscope is not going to match it with a therapy so appropriately.
So have you got any imatinib patients out there like this surgeon?
Well, the longest treated patient for us with a c-KIT mutation on imatinib is still only 8 months, so still a short time.
But you've seen good responses?
There are, in essentially all cases, again, these 8 patients scattered around the country who've been reported to date, none of them have had their disease progress yet after initially responding. And they haven't been stable. They've responded. They've really had tumor regression. So it's early days. In fact, if you look at JCO, 3-4 weeks ago, roughly, the first published report of one of these patients is now in the literature. So this is just an example of trying to chip away, if you will, at subsets for which a certain therapy is the appropriate one. Now, c-KIT mutation is a pretty easy biomarker to test for. We just don't have a good biomarker for these CTLA-4 antibodies. We don't have a good biomarker for sorafenib chemotherapy-responsive patients. We've treated so many of them in trials that we've done, and since our group is leading the big cooperative group trial that's completed accrual, we actually have analysis underway in tumor tissue to try to identify those markers.
You know, it's interesting. Again, a lot of times the oncologist sees these papers come out and the data overall don't look. Of course, you're looking at the whole population,
yeah.
You know, just like,
yes.
You know, HER2.
Yes.
If you didn't have HER2, we never would have been able to figure out what was going on with trastuzumab. But I was thinking as you were talking last night, we had a symposium about lung cancer where you're talking about EGFR mutations in non-small cell. And, you know, prior to that, again, we had these data with me, I guess, gefitinib, and it kind of looked like a little whiff better. And it was like nobody was really impressed.
Yes.
But within there,
yes.
There were these
yes.
patients who had these incredible responses.
Exactly.
And I think when you know there are patients like that, as opposed to everybody's just getting a little bit of benefit. It kind of has a different feel to it.
Absolutely. And to me, that's going to be the story in every cancer where you're going to have to break down the homogeneity of the histologic diagnosis into these distinct biologic subsets. It seems easier with EGFR mutation and c-KIT mutation. You know, these are really binary events that you can test for so readily than I think it will be in several other cancer types. I think it might be a little bit more of a challenge in some other tumors.